here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us.
Today is Friday, the 9th of January. I'm Rohith Joseph.
And I'm Alex Sarah Davis. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5:01 p.m. and time for a full hour of independent campus, local, and international news. Today's top stories and segments are a recap of all the events you might have missed over the December break, featuring myself and Alex, as well as news director Costa Pradonovich. Stay tuned for News 101's official winter break roundup.
We also have a radio essay by Emily Blake in which she comments on the recent controversy over the Seth Rogen comedy, The Interview.
Later in the program, we have your AMS update brought to you by Moira Warburton.
We also have an interview with a body removal technician about the intricacies of dealing with death on a daily basis.
But first, some headlines for today. In local news, Halesook First Nation for provincial intervention calls for provincial intervention before toxic waste spills across BC coast. According to a revealing document from the Taii, a marine disaster is unfolding on BC's central coast near the abandoned site of Namu, a former Halesook village. More recently, Namu was a BC Packers salmon cannery. However, during the cannery's closing in 1969, site operators failed to ensure the proper disposal of potentially toxic chemicals from the fish canning process. The site has been without supervision since 2013, when Namu's last caretaker left a derelict ship, originally moored to the site as part of a cleanup effort, is slowly decaying and further exacerbating the situation. Wildlife advocacy group Pacific Wild has recently drawn attention to the situation with a time-lapse video showing the abandoned ship repeatedly slamming into the former cannery, which appears to be leaking. In 2011, the cannery's remaining chemicals were identified as sulfuric acid, ammonia, copper, lead, and hydrocarbons from tank frames. Groups including Pacific Wild and Halesook First Nation are concerned that the abandoned structures will fall into the water, releasing contaminants and producing a risk to British Columbia's coastal marine habitats. Currently, these groups are raising awareness about the effects that the chemicals will have on the environment if released. In particular, the Halesook claim that the contaminants are a significant threat to the salmon population that is relied upon as their primary source of food. Halesook Nation Aquatic Manager Mike Reed contacted Canadian Coast Guard last October with his concerns about the cannery's erosion. David Milne, head of Namu Properties and current owner of the site, responded by claiming that he would remove the ship by the end of the month. At this stage, the site will require at least two separate cleanup efforts, one to remove contaminants from the cannery itself and one to remove the ship and ensure the water is as clean as possible. As the current owner, Milne is taking responsibility for some of the cleanup. He has stated that the derelict ship will be towed to Richmond by the end of January. This will prevent the continued and rapid deterioration of the site, but it does not solve the problem of the cannery's contaminants themselves.
In national news, Dalhousie dentistry students are suspended for threats and misogynistic comments. Last month, a number of misogynistic comments on the Class of DDS 2015 Gentlemen Facebook page came to light, throwing the university into the midst of national controversy. The commenters joked about chloroforming their female classmates in order to have sex with them, made threats of sexual assault and harassment, and voted on which women they would most like to have, quote, hate sex with. On Monday, Dalhousie University announced it would be suspending the 13 male dentistry students responsible. Originally, the university was going to employ a restorative justice process as a first response and sent out questionnaires to the female students targeted by the comments, asking what measures should be taken. However, students and staff alike are concerned that restorative justice places undue burdens on the victims. Four faculty members have made public a complaint launched to update the university's policies on restorative justice, explaining, quote, "We as faculty made this decision for two reasons, so that no student need feel pressured to come forward themselves, and that no student feel or bear any consequences for making a complaint." On Monday, hundreds of protesters stood outside the president's office building, demanding that the students be expelled and that more be done to address the sexism on campus. After announcing that the students would be suspended, the university made no comment about whether they would go ahead with their plan of restorative justice. Some are taking the matter into their own hands on and off campus. The Provincial Dental Board of Nova Scotia has released a statement warning that it may not allow the students responsible to practice in their province. And Ontario's Royal College of Dental Surgeons has asked Dalhousie for the names of the 13 men. Erwin Pfeffergrad, the college's registrar, stated that all future applicants from Dalhousie Dentistry Program would be questioned if the college does not receive the list of names. Explaining the decision, Pfeffergrad said that, quote, "As the regulatory body in Ontario, we need to make sure that the public is protected and that anybody we give a license to is safe to practice," adding that this includes ensuring, quote, "the individual is of good moral fiber and has not done anything of this kind."
Gian Gomeshi faces three new sexual assault charges. Three new charges of sexual assault have been laid against former CBC radio host Gian Gomeshi. In total, Gomeshi faces seven counts of sexual assault and one charge of overcoming resistance by choking. Gomeshi's lawyer, Marie Hanine, made a brief statement to state that her client will plead not guilty to all charges. The new charges are a result of three women who have recently come forward. The women are among 15 who have shared their stories of their alleged sexual abuse and harassment at Gomeshi's hands. The three alleged sexual assaults took place in August 2002, July 2003, and February 2008, and a publication ban has been placed on the identities of the three plaintiffs. Gomeshi's next scheduled court appearance is February 4th, when his lawyer is expected to speak on his behalf. CBC has also hired employment lawyer Janice Rubin to conduct an investigation into the corporation's handling of the allegations and Gomeshi's termination. Canada opens door to 13,000 Syrian and Iraqi refugees. Immigration Minister Chris Alexander announced Wednesday that Canada would accept an additional 10,000 Syrian refugees over the next 3 years and 3,000 Iraqi refugees by the end of 2015. Ottawa expects 60% of refugees to be funded through private sponsorship from humanitarian and church groups. The immigration minister's announcement followed an appeal from the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees in December, asking countries to increase their refugee intake in response to the worsening humanitarian crisis in the Middle East. Syrians have recently become the largest population of refugees under the UN's mandate. NDP MP Paul Dewar has expressed concern that the government may not have the resources necessary to process the sudden influx of refugees, given past difficulties. Executive Director of the Canadian Council for Refugees, Janet Dench, has warned that there is currently an over-reliance on private sponsors for immigrating refugees, and that this reliance undermines Canada's pledge. Sponsoring an individual refugee can take up to $12,000, with families costing up to $25,000, in addition to food, housing, and health coverage costs not covered by Ottawa. MP Dewar said that the majority of refugee sponsorship should be provided by the government, as opposed to private grassroots organizations. Further support for this claim came from Amnesty International, who stated that government expectations for private sponsorship sponsorship is, quote, extraordinary.
And finally, in international news, gunmen attack Charlie Hebdo magazine offices in Paris. On Wednesday, three masked gunmen attacked the headquarters of French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo, killing 12 people, including senior staff and two police officers. French President François Hollande has dubbed the attack an act of terror and of, quote, exceptional barbarity. The primary suspects were identified as brothers Saïd and Sharif Kouachi and Hamid Mourad. After being identified as a suspect, Mourad walked to a police station in Charleville-Mézières and turned himself in. Last night, the Kouachi brothers were involved in a high-speed chase leading to a warehouse and a raid that resulted in their deaths early this morning. The attack on Charlie Hebdo is believed to be the deadliest attack on French soil since 1961, when right-wing radicals, angry that Algeria would no longer be French, bombed a train and killed 28 people. The attack has increased tensions around the large population of French Muslims, with many viewing this as an attack on free speech. However, the story is not as simple as it first seems. Charlie Hebdo has a long history of printing questionable material, with critics accusing it of racism and anti-Muslim sentiments. The paper, formerly known as Harakiri, gained national attention in 1970 with a headline mocking the death of former President Charles de Gaulle. In response, the French government shut down the magazine. In 2006, the now rebranded magazine reprinted cartoon depictions of the Prophet Muhammad that were originally published in a Danish newspaper several months earlier. The Danish cartoons provoked riots, and Charlie Hebdo's editors were initially charged with inciting racial hatred, before eventually being acquitted. In 2011, only 4 years ago, Charlie Hebdo published a special issue stating it was, quote, guest edited by Muhammad, and that there would be, quote, 100 lashes if you didn't die laughing. In response, the magazine's website was hacked and its offices were firebombed. Following the firebombing incident, a French police officer was assigned to protect the magazine's staff and was one of the two officers to be killed during Wednesday's attack. To what extent Charlie Hebdo's provocative material crossed the line remain topics of debate. But there has been an outpouring of support for the attack's 12 victims from both domestic and international communities. As independent journalists, we here at News 101 stand in solidarity with the victims of the attack on Charlie Hebdo. Any attack on the free press is an attack on the principles which we live by, too.
Those are your campus, local, national, and international headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned.
As Minister for Magic, it gives me great pleasure to welcome each and every one of you to the final of the 422nd Quidditch World Cup. Let the match begin!
That's right, UBC has a Quidditch team and we're the fastest ones yet. Come join us at practice every Thursday at 5 and Sunday at 12 to show us your house pride. You can also get on our level with our Quidditch swag. We have bro tanks, t-shirts and sunglasses, all which go towards getting us to the World Cup. Not sure where to find the snitch? Well, like us on Facebook or check out our website at ubcquidditch.com and we'll be more helpful than you'll remember all. And remember, we want a nice clean game from all of you.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us. Up next, we have a recap of all the events you might have missed over the December break. Myself, Alexander Davis, Sarah Davis, and Costa Prodanovich present News 101's official winter break roundup.
Here at CITR, we understand that the holidays are a time to wind down, let go of the news for a little bit, and cozy up with the novel in a big blanket. But now, it's time to get back to reality. Pick up that paper and crank your radio. We are here to help you catch up with all the alternative news you might have missed over the last month of lethargy and blissful ignorance. This is your Winter Break News Roundup.
Many of you have probably been away from our UBC campus over the holiday season.
which has left it pretty barren as far as student news is concerned. However, UBC researchers have been as busy as ever.
UBC astronomers have confirmed the existence of a new superplanet. Researcher Jamie Matthews, who doubles as a mission scientist with Canada's first space telescope, confirmed the existence of a new planet 180 light-years away from Earth. The exoplanet's official name is HIP-116454b. Matthews' team said that the new planet is too close to its sun to be habitable, but they say they are hopeful it is only one of a system of planets around the star that may be more welcoming.
UBC professor David Granville and his team of scientists have discovered the secret to combating aging skin. During an experiment with mice exploring the effects of a protein-degrading enzyme called Granzyme B, Granville noticed that the mice engineered to lack this enzyme had remarkably improved and wrinkle-free skin. Granzyme B breaks down proteins and interferes with the organization and the integrity of collagen, dismantling the scaffolding or extracellular matrix that cells bind to. This causes structural weakness, leading to wrinkles. Accordingly, Granville and his team are now focused on developing inhibitors that halt Granzyme B's activity, which will help prevent the degradation of this extracellular matrix.
Perhaps the biggest story to come out of campus over the last month came from the university president's office. On December 18th, President Gupta released a video of himself accepting Bob Geldof's Band-Aid challenge.
I accept and will be donating 10 pounds, approximately 18 Canadian dollars, on the Band-Aid 30 website.
Geldof, a former Georgia Strait music editor and frontman of the Boomtown Rats, started the challenge.
The UBC community is actively contributing to its efforts to combat Ebola. Researchers, faculty members, and students are providing their expertise both here and on the ground in West Africa.
Band-Aid is a charity supergroup composed of mainly British and Irish musicians and recording artists. It was founded in 1984 by Bob Geldof as an initiative to fight poverty in Africa, particularly to raise money for famine relief in Ethiopia. The charity has been reinvigorated lately by the ongoing Ebola crisis. Geldof's most recent challenge has been posed in an effort to raise money for Ebola relief in West Africa.
However, Band-Aid has been a locus of controversy almost since its inception. The song "Do They Know It's Christmas" has long been criticized for being patronizing towards Africa in general. Moreover, Band-Aid has been accused of perpetuating stereotypes and misconceptions about Africa. Critics say that it reinforces a white savior complex, which implies that Africa is necessarily dependent on aid from the Western world. Gupta has faced similar criticism from campus activists who attacked him, saying he, quote, donated around $18 to the overall $1.5 million raised for the Africa Saving Initiative, while he also bought into possibly the single most outdated, offensive, and racist song of 2014. The administration has not responded, and it likely won't. Gupta has nominated student presidents Tanner Boker and Rocky Kim to participate, and it is yet to be seen whether they will.
In more local news, an ancient Coast Salish ceremony took place in Vancouver's City Hall over the break. The Cedar Bow Brushing Ceremony marked what Mayor Gregor Robertson called a new beginning in cooperation between the city and the three nations, Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh. The ceremony was part of the city's Year of Reconciliation, a partnership project with Reconciliation Canada, in which the city acknowledged the negative cultural impacts and stereotypes that resulted from Canada's residential school system, witnessed the process of reconciliation and healing, and moved forward with a greater shared understanding of the historical impacts that have shaped the experiences of Aboriginal peoples to date.
Two of BC's First Nations groups launched the first legal challenge against the LNG industry. The Nadli Wootin and the Nakazidli First Nations filed for a judicial review of TransCanada Corps' Coastal GasLink pipeline project in Vancouver's courthouse. The First Nations group's main grievance concerns the Crown's failure in abiding by their duty to consult while undergoing the approval process of the 650-kilometer natural gas pipeline. The Coastal GasLink project would carry gas from the Montney Formation near Dawson Creek to the proposed LNG Canada export facility near Kitimat. LNG Canada is owned by a consortium that includes Shell, Korea's KOGAS, and PetroChina. In a news release, Chief Fred Sam of Naukazdli First Nation made it clear that him and the people he represents are, quote, not against development, and that, quote, the LNG industry is just as frustrated as they are with how BC is managing its relationships with First Nations, especially after the Supreme Court's decision in the Chikolten case this year. Over the past year, other First Nations groups in BC have also opted for litigation against Enbridge Inc.'s Northern Gateway oil pipeline, as well as BC Hydro's Site C hydroelectric dam.
Low oil prices have been threatening to rock the Canadian economy. International oil prices have been plummeting since June. So far, they have slipped nearly 55% amid a glut in the global supply. On Tuesday, the price of crude oil fell to $47.93 a barrel, the lowest it's been since April of 2009. For Canadians, this makes for some uncertain economic prospects.
Canada's got a free market economy. We're open to innovation in a way that other folks have challenges with. We can engage these ecosystems in a way to make a very competitive oil product on environmental performance.
In recent years, Canada has often been labeled a petro-state, much to the chagrin of our federal government with its stated goals of expanding business in Canada's tar sands. With global oil markets in freefall, we can expect to see a reduction in investments on pipelines and other oil projects, employment problems in northern Alberta, and a declining Canadian dollar. Experts theorize that the economies of British Columbia and Ontario will grow slightly due to the subsequently reduced costs of manufacturing. However, the same experts point out that the Canadian economy is much more reliant on the energy sector than it was previously. Canadian manufacturing has declined significantly in the past decade, and much of the infrastructure has been abandoned or dismantled. By contrast, energy exports make up nearly 30% of Canadian exports currently, valued around $80 billion, and are 7% of our GDP. It seems we are failing to keep our economic eggs out of one basket. The extent of the market slump remains to be seen, and prices may bounce back at any time. According to the economist Terry Lynn Carl, recently interviewed by the TIE, quote, the price of oil is more volatile than ever before, and the economies of producing and consuming countries are more intertwined than ever before. The most effective means of separating ourselves from this volatility as a country is to wean off our reliance on oil as our major export. Canada needs to diversify its resource exports if it hopes to maintain a stable economy in these times of stress.
Taliban militants stormed an army school in Peshawar, Pakistan, killing 141 students and teachers. On December 16, 2014, nine members of Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, also known as the Pakistani Taliban, disguised themselves in military uniforms and entered into an army public school in Peshawar, shooting students, teachers, and school workers indiscriminately. Many of the 141 that were killed were students between the ages of 8 to 18 years old. By the end of the bloody siege, the Pakistani military killed 6 of the 9 attackers. 3 died by executing suicide bomb attacks. Sami Yusufazi, a reporter for the Daily Beast, spoke to Jihad Yar Wazir, a commander of the Taliban, asking why they committed the attack on a school. Wazir responded by saying, quote, the parents of the army school are army soldiers, and they are behind the massive killing of our kids and indiscriminate bombing in north and south Waziristan. To hurt them at their safe haven and homes, such an attack is perfect revenge. The brutal nature of the attack was condemned universally in Pakistan. In a statement to the press, Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif said, quote, this is a national tragedy unleashed by savages. These were my kids. This is my loss. This is the nation's loss. The Peshawar massacre, now known as Black Tuesday in Pakistan, has escalated military operations and reinforced anti-Taliban sentiment in the nation.
That was your CITR News 101 Winter Break Roundup. We hope you had a great time ringing in the new year. And like you, we here have some resolutions. We want to continue to provide our listeners with original, interesting, and independent content. And as far as some formatting changes are concerned, we intend to release a weekly radio essay on our SoundCloud, which will re-air on the Friday show. It will be like a think piece on current events of the week, written by our reporters and staff here. And our third resolution is to increase our coverage of student politics and thereby better inform and involve the student body here at UBC. These are our New Year's resolutions for 2015, and we hope to live by these and our current goals for bringing you independent, interesting news coverage of current events on a weekly basis. Thank you for tuning in, and we hope here at CITR News 101 that you have a great 2015. Please listen in. And thank you to Costa for that report. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments here on CITR 101.9 FM.
Do you hear what I'm hearing?
Come enjoy British Columbia's beautiful wilderness with the UBC Varsity Outdoors Club. Try your hand at hiking, backcountry skiing, rock climbing, kayaking, and much more. Whether you're a beginner or an expert, we have trips happening every week, usually at no cost.
Living my dream.
Check us out online at ubc-voc.com.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. Broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thanks for being with us.
Up next, we have a radio essay by Emily Blake, in which she comments on the recent controversy over the Seth Rogen comedy, The Interview.
Currently, 24 million people in North Korea live under the most repressive totalitarian regime in the world. They face some of the worst living conditions, including food shortages, arbitrary arrests, and no rights or freedoms. Approximately 200,000 North Koreans are believed to be trapped in gulags, where they endure heinous living conditions, forced labor, and unimaginable torture. Despite denials by the North Korean government, the world has been told all this by individuals who have managed to escape their control. But what mass media, activists, and even American President Barack Obama have been discussing about North Korea has nothing to do with any of these concerning facts. They are all talking about a terrible comedy that centers around assassinating North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un. Yes, I am talking about The Interview. It is alarming that Judd Apatow, Seth Rogen, and James Franco, among others, have chosen to make a comedy about a nation whose people are currently suffering so greatly. Some critics are concerned that assassination is nothing to joke about, but what is perhaps most concerning is that a serious opportunity to discuss human rights has been missed and instead been used to make cheap jokes for big profits. The film earned more than $25 million through online sales in its first 4 days of release, none of which will go towards bettering the lives of North Koreans. Listen to Yeonmi Peck speak about her life in North Korea at the One Young World Summit 2014 in Dublin.
North Korea is an unimaginable country. There is only one channel on TV. There is no internet. We aren't free to sing, say, wear, or think what we want. North Korea is the only country in the world that executes people for making unauthorized international phone calls. North Koreans are being terrorized today. I was born in 1993, and I was abducted at birth, even before I knew the words freedom or human rights.
Many have hailed The Interview as a symbol of free expression, as Sony cyber hackers nearly succeeded in preventing the film's release. It is a hypocrisy that people are more concerned about their right to watch this film than the basic human rights of North Koreans. Some have even compared the film to Charlie Chaplin's The Great Dictator, a film applauded as a stand against Hitler during World War II.
By the promise of these things, brutes have risen to power, but they lie. They do not fulfill that promise. They never will. Dictators free themselves, but they enslave the people.
However, The Interview is not an attempt to make a clever criticism of North Korean totalitarianism. It uses Kim Jong-un's oddities for mockery, along with a collection of stereotypical, racist, and homophobic jokes. Chaplin said himself of the Great Dictator in his 1964 autobiography that, "Had I known of the actual horrors of the German concentration camps, I could not have made The Great Dictator. I could not have made fun of the homicidal insanity of the Nazis." Adrian Hong, the managing director of Pegasus Strategies and co-founder and former executive director of the human rights awareness organization Liberty in North Korea, has written a must-read piece in The Atlantic titled North Korea, Not Funny. In it, he criticized the interview as cowardly and calls it out for using cheap jokes at the expense of discussing the real horrors of North Korea. He writes, "This film is not an act of courage. It is not a stand against totalitarianism, concentration camps, mass starvation, or state-sponsored terror. It is simply a comedy made by a group of talented actors, writers, and directors and intended, like most comedies, to make money and earn laughs." He ends the piece by saying, "The day will soon come when North Koreans are finally free and liberated concentration camp survivors will have to learn the world was more interested in the oddities of the oppressors than the torment of the oppressed." Looking at films like Sacha Baron Cohen's The Dictator, I cannot help but question why they felt the need to use a real country to make this comedy. Although I agree that the interview should not be banned, I believe the film has no redeeming qualities and is in poor taste. All the discussion and attention this film has received has done nothing but increase the profits and viewership of the film. I can understand why people may be curious to watch this film, but going to watch the interview is not a courageous act of supporting freedom. It is merely financially supporting a huge corporation that cares more for profits than decency or human rights. It's time that we change the conversation and focus on what really matters. People need to become more educated about the plight of the North Korean people and what we can do to help.
Thanks to Emily Blake for that essay. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM.
Slow down. You're not in a race. Alcohol-related deaths are one of the leading preventable causes of death in Canada. Please remember to drink responsibly.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
For our next segment on the show, we have your AMS update brought to you by Moira Warburton.
Hi, I'm Moira Warburton, and I am bringing you, CITR, your AMS report of the first meeting of the AMS in 2015. It was a long meeting. There was a lot to discuss. First on the agenda was a presentation from the UBC administration. The main gist of the presentation was that they are increasing non-refundable deposits put down by students accepting their offer to UBC by 100% for undergrads and 500% increase for students of Vantage College. This is quite a significant increase. The rationale for was basically that it encourages good faith acceptance. Students aren't going to accept to UBC and then 2 months later, when they get accepted somewhere else, change their minds and retract that acceptance. If they're putting down hard cash, they will really have to make a decision and then stick with it. This then makes it easier for the administration to do some better resource planning and to organize course schedules and course hiring professors more in advance. So that was the rationale for the increase. The next presentation at the AMS meeting was by Block Party, the events coordinator, Anna Hilliard. They have found a venue, which is super exciting, although they couldn't tell us where. It needed to be kept a secret. This was not made clear why it needed to be kept a secret, but it did, so I'm not going to argue with it. The venue will be able to fit 4,800 people. This is in comparison with 6,700 last year, so it's quite a significant drop, but at least they've got a venue. They presented the budget. The budget has a potential loss of $38,000. This is significant, but this is, she made clear that this is a worst case scenario budget. They've never averaged more than an $18,000 loss. They usually say they'll lose around $30,000. They've never lost more than $18,000. In reality, last year they actually made a profit. So this is a worst case scenario budget. The next item on the agenda of interest was the transit referendum. So a presentation was made by representatives from a coalition called Get On Board BC. They were basically talking to the AMS. The point of their presentation was that they want to work with the AMS to get students involved in the transit referendum, which will be happening by the end of March. It's a mail-in referendum. So you have them. So Elections BC will mail you a ballot. You have a month and a half to mail it back. If you go to our Twitter feed, at CITR News, we posted a link to Elections BC website where you can register for to be part of the referendum. A month and a half is actually, and the mail-in ballot is actually not a bad thing because it gives Get On Board BC and the AMS, if the AMS chooses to partner with them, a lot of campaigning time. They want students to say yes to the transit referendum. This is because transit affects a lot, like basically all students. 78% of undergrads commute and 98% of grads commute using transit daily. So any updates to the transit system in Vancouver would have a major impact on UBC students. So Get On Board BC wants to partner with the AMS and basically develop a communication strategy, create a working committee, and support the yes side for the transit referendum. Another big ticket item for the AMS last night was that they are updating their computer software system. So they, after a lot of consultations, they had a working committee. The recommendation of the committee is to go with OrgSync. It's fairly expensive. The end budget was, I believe, around $64,000 for a two-year contract, but OrgSync should be implemented because it covers all of the AMS's requirements for a computer system. So it's much more efficient. It has a user-friendly interface. It's possible to integrate with other parts of the AMS that the AMS impacts, so like clubs or speakeasy, or it makes it a lot easier to combine and really smooths out the user experience. And it has really positive reviews. It's designed for universities and it has a lot of positive reviews and a 95% retention rate from universities that have also used this. So that got a lot of discussion within the AMS council, i.e. this is a big expenditure of money. Are we sure about this? How are we going to implement it? Etc. So the end result was that we will be assigning a two-year contract with OrgSync. 2 years is good because it allows us a chance to implement the system and then a year to implement and then a year to actually see its benefits. And then if we like it, we can sign a five-year contract, but we don't have to talk about that right now. So the other part of the meeting that was discussed was about the sub-building. They discussed this at the last meeting that met quorum, so that was November 19th. Ava and Asiri mentioned that we would be looking into canceling the contracts that we currently have of the reno of the old sub. This is because there would be coordination issues between the renovation and the building of the new sub. It's also quite a big expenditure of money. If we canceled, we would get a $2.3 million credit with the contract company, which we are currently working with to build the sub. So that would be a really good thing. There was also a lot of discussion about this, i.e., how much money are we losing out on by canceling this contract now? The answer was that it's hard to judge this because when we signed on to do the sub renovation, we signed on for the whole project. So this renovation of the sub is the third phase of the sub construction, because when we signed the contract, we agreed to all three phases in one lump sum. It's hard to say how much this phase three would actually cost because it's scaled into the other two phases. So all we can really say for sure is that we would be saving about $2.3 million by canceling contracts now, and it's beneficial to do it sooner rather than later because the materials won't be purchased. We give the companies more advance warning. So the end decision is that we will be canceling the renovation of the sub. The other good news of the night was that tentatively, extremely tentatively, the sub is on schedule for its April opening, which is awesome. And because we delayed opening, which is not awesome, but yeah, because we delayed opening, we actually unexpectedly collected an extra year of fees for towards the sub. So how students have had that little sub fee, like $5 or $10 per student, tacked onto their student fees, we collected an extra year of those by delaying opening. So that's extra money in a very badly needed budget. We also had two students at large presenting last night regarding the Divest UBC campaign. This campaign, although they didn't actually say, this campaign is works towards divesting UBC of investments in oil and other dirty fuels. They had heard that the AMS Council would be discussing this policy in their meeting last night, and so they wanted to come into UBC and remind the AMS Council that that a referendum passed last term with 76% of the student population voting yes to divest UBC. That is a huge amount of the student population coming out. Yeah, so they wanted to remind the AMS Council that they represent UBC. This is what UBC wants. You should probably divest UBC. In the president's remarks, the Centennial Fund, this is a fund created by UBC that's accessible to students who have ideas for projects or events to celebrate UBC's centennial. The Centennial Fund has had a lot of really good applications for money. This is awesome to see so much enthusiasm about this. Applications are still open, so if you wanted to apply, you should do so. And that was your AMS Council meeting last night.
Thank you for that, Moira. So it really was a long meeting, though, hey?
It was a very long meeting. Yeah, I don't know if you follow our Twitter feed. You should. But, yeah, if you remember that scene from the Black Breakfast Club where they're all sleeping on the desks and they slump their hands up, that was basically voting by the end, and I don't blame them. So.
I think the biggest story of the night, though, is hearing that the sub is on time to open.
Yes, she was very clear. Ava Nasiri was very clear that this is tentative. Right now it's on schedule. It might not stay on schedule, but right now it is on schedule. So that was really good to hear.
That's better news than we've been getting lately. So I am very glad to hear that, and I'm sure a lot of our student listeners will be too.
Yes.
Anyways, thank you so much for that AMS update. That was Moira Warburton.
Thank you very much.
And we're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments.
This Jan-cember, keep yourself warm with our double deluxe issue of Discorder. Get yourself caught under the mistletoe with our special cover article on Rec Center. Ring in the new year with features on Vancouver art spaces and the heroes of Shindig.
3, 2, 1, Happy New Year!
And please remember to solemnly celebrate January solstice in a traditional way, with articles on Candela Farm and Witch of the Waste.
So please check out the Jan-cember issue of Discorder, and we'll see you again in February.
Lorem ipsum, lorem ipsum,
And special thanks go out to our advertisers of this issue: LiveVan.com, Vinyl Records, Rickshaw, The Fox Cabaret, AMS Events, Audio Pile, Light Organ Records, Extra Living, Sad Mag, Flemish Eye, and the Presentation House Theater.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Alex Sarah Davis.
And I'm Rohit Joseph. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, or online at citr.ca. Thank you for being with us.
Up next on the program, we have a segment with Costa Pradanovich, where he interviews a body removal technician about the intricacies of the job and dealing with death on a daily basis.
Usually I go looking for stories. I do my research and approach sources with intent. Very rarely does a story come to me. This one did. I was visiting friends and family for the holidays, and over a few drinks and some catching up with one of my high school friends, he mentions that his older brother, Ian, has been having job trouble. He begins to list the jobs that Ian has done in the last few months in an attempt to make ends meet. And somewhere in this conglomerate list of jobs, my friend mentions that Ian had worked as a body removal technician. Or in more crude terms, someone who transports dead bodies for a living. This piqued my interest, and I immediately messaged Ian with the idea of having him tell me more about his experience. So Ian, what does a day in the life of a body removal technician look like?
I gotta say, it's pretty smelly. It's kind of cold. You're in a van. You're trying not to touch too much stuff. Like, there's a garbage bag in the center console area just full of gloves that have been touching dead bodies. So you're in the van. You have your paperwork set, basically. It's like just tedious information you got to fill out when you pick up a body. But basically, you get on the scene. First thing you do is you put on your gloves. You approach the body. You talk to the people, you know, sort of wait until they give you permission. Usually there's a coroner there, and you just wait till they give you permission, and then you proceed to move the body onto a gurney any way you can.
There's something you have to understand about Ian. He's a character. Ian is one of the most honest people I have ever met, and by virtue of this, he is also incredibly blunt. Immediately after giving me this rundown, he dives into an anecdote.
So one time we had a person who just, we don't know what happened. Like, we think she got murdered in her car because there was like something bleeding from her eyes, and she was passed out in the driver's seat with her head like piled down on the side in the shotgun seat. And so the police were like, well, we need to move this body. So probably bring the gurney around this way. And my boss Ray was like, no, we're the pros at removing bodies. We're going to bring her all the way through the car, through the shotgun door.
At this point, I'm hooked on this story. Although, I begin to worry about the frankness of Ian's commentary. Is he perhaps saying too much too fast? I try to steer the conversation towards the intricacies of the job itself.
Before we get too far into the intricacies, I'd just like to ask you how you first got involved in this kind of work.
Oh man, it was really sketchy. I just needed a job.
What was the process like? Did you go and drop off a resume?
No, not at all. We were downtown just playing tennis, and this guy was approaching people randomly in the park.
So you were downtown with your friends playing tennis?
Yeah, me, my brother, and his friend Kyle.
And a random stranger,
complete stranger. We thought maybe he was trying to sell drugs or something, but no, he was old. He was wearing an NYPD shirt.
He wasn't trying to sell drugs. He was trying to get you to carry dead bodies.
Yeah.
For a moment, I'm relieved that we have qualified the fact that being approached in a park about being a body service technician is, quote, sketchy.
So he comes, he speaks to my brother, he goes, do you need a job? My brother's like, no, my brother needs a job. And I'm like, yeah, I need a job. I'm willing to work weekends. Like, I really want to work weekends, and like, I'm fine. So he's like, oh, okay, how do you feel about you heavy lifting? I'm like, I'm good with heavy lifting. He's like, how do you feel about heavy lifting dead people? I'm like, yeah, I can do that. I was like, that is actually really interesting. I do want to try that.
So right away, you were ready to go as far
yeah,
as...
Yeah, yeah. I'd never seen a dead person like... only in a casket. So I really wanted to just give it a shot.
So on your first day of work, was there any sort of training involved? Or did they kind of get you just...
Yeah, actually, there was. Like, it took a while for the process to start. Because, you know, first he's some sketchy guy, and I think he was worried about coming off sketchy. Because... obviously. And
yeah, so, that's
pretty normal. So like, he's trying to, you know, act. I think he was trying to make me want the job by kind of like saying, oh no, not this week, next week kind of thing. So I was waiting, and I was actually working somewhere else. I was just looking for a second job. Mm-hmm. And weekends was perfect. So we're trying to coordinate our schedules. Eventually I quit my other job, and the first thing was an orientation where we just talked about like how to safely lift without hurting your back.
What was said at that orientation?
Just sort of like when you're... Oh, it kind of freaked me out. We were talking about like how like if you get into a hospital, you got to like pull the sheets over top of the body so you don't touch the body and lift from the sheets.
So at this point, are you a little bit intimidated about your chosen job?
Well, I'm kind of just like feeling very morbid because everybody who's there doesn't really look like they're having fun. They're just kind of like really laid back, and it's just so dry. Like, the material was so dry. We're just talking about like how to lift and move dead bodies onto a gurney and not hurt yourself. Like, it just seemed like so remorse, you know.
And you were working on call, if I'm correct.
Yeah, so they would just call me anytime during the weekend.
So you wake up in the morning, you have your morning coffee, and you get a phone call. What are you wearing to work?
Well, usually I go to my car, and I just strip down and change into the clothes that I have in the back, which is black pair of pants, black leather shoes, a belt, and a dress shirt, which I tuck in. They told me to, like, maybe get a tie, and I didn't really worry about it.
I'm almost charmed by this little tidbit of information. It seems both absurd and appropriate that a body removal technician would be required to dress as formally as possible. Part of me had assumed that there was maybe a work uniform involved, or even possibly a hazmat suit. But the fact that a body removal technician is dressed the same way as any lawyer or broker seemed allegorically fitting looking back on it. At this point, I began to wonder what a body removal situation must be like for all the parties involved, and I began to pry for a moment of empathy from Ian.
Obviously, this sort of work requires a lot of empathy, or I'd assume it requires a lot of empathy when you're approaching distraught families or instances where the death was unprecedented. How do you go about being understanding and respectful towards the families of the deceased?
Ian is very blunt with me.
You try to look as sad as possible.
I'm almost frustrated by this response. I wanted to assume that there was a level of genuine empathy required in this type of work. As an interviewer, I want to keep my subjectivity aside and let my interviewee guide the story. But in this case, I couldn't help but feel the need to want Ian's empathy. I wanted him to care about the people whose bodies he was working with. At the time, I felt that it was important to the story. I thought that if I could break through the bluntness of his character and garner some emotion, I might have been able to create a moment that would resonate with our audience. A human moment.
Was there a level of professionalism as far as you being taught at orientation to approach the body, to approach the family?
There wasn't much. It was more just go with your common sense. You're new. I was new, so he said, just try not to speak. Let me do the talking. He would usually approach and just say, hi, he was very charismatic. He was kind of like a salesman.
Who's this?
Ray Turner.
Ray Turner.
He was my boss. He's the guy who approached me with wearing the NYPD shirt, probably 65 years old. So he was very just upfront, kind of almost aggressive, but nice.
How did you feel in these situations?
I was fine with it.
Really?
I was fine with it.
What was going through your head? I mean, especially...
I'm going to make money at the end of the day. That's all I was thinking.
All you saw was the money.
Yeah, all I saw was the money. I'm literally just a person there who's hired and is like going to make money off this. Like, I'm like, okay, I don't care if nobody remembers me when I leave. Just, that's it. Like,
so, did you consciously try and approach the situations that numbly, or was that...
I don't know if I was trying to be. I was very numb to most of the situations. I think what I was trying to do is just not make anything worse, because there's really nothing you can do.
Right.
There was one time where I said, listen, I'm really sorry for your loss. I wish there was something I would do. It's sad to see.
And what kind of a reaction did that get? So
she just started bawling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can imagine that being tough.
Yeah.
Looking back on it now, did you feel like you made some sort of a connection with the families, or did you try and stay as distant as possible?
Definitely distant. There's no way I want to keep a relationship with anybody I'm working with, like, through that sort of, that's how you get to know the person? No.
Without outing anyone's identity, is there any specific cases that come to mind that are particularly memorable for you? I know you mentioned one at the beginning, but is there any other case that?
Oh, yeah.
Considering this question in hindsight, I realized that it basically opened the interview up for the full wrath of Ian's candidness.
I never thought it would happen, but on October 30th, there was a murder in the city bus, and it was basically like a Jack the Ripper style, only it was a man who was murdered, and there was a woman on the bus. The person slit the guy's throat, it like right through the trachea. I don't know exactly what happened, but I heard the story from a paramedic friend who I was with working on ski patrol, who told me that the lady beside him actually tried to stop the bleeding by taking her sweater and pushing it up against his throat. It's true, because I saw the bloody sweater next to the guy. And that was kind of... I remember just getting on that scene and being like, holy cow, this is serious. Like, there's tape where we're waiting to be given permission to enter into sort of the scene.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a whole debate. I made some calls about, like, how we were going to approach it, you know, like, where we were going to put the gurney.
That must have been intimidating.
It really wasn't, because, like, it was just another body. You know, you just got to get... you're just moving it.
And listening to the playback, I realize now that this is Ian's entire approach to this job. For him, it's just that. It's just another body.
So once you have the body in your car, where's the first place you go?
Well, it depends. Is it a coroner call or is it a...
What would be the difference?
A residence call. Well, the residence call, you go straight to a funeral home.
Okay.
If it's a coroner call, it means that the body died under suspicious or unknown circumstances. So you bring it to the morgue. Right. And if you bring it to the morgue, you have to fill out additional paperwork, you know, sign off. And you'll usually have to also bring the body back a few days afterwards to the funeral home that the body's to be sent to.
Right. Is there services available as far as debriefing is concerned?
Debriefing? Nope.
There was nothing.
There was nothing. I'm just a body removal technician. As far as I'm concerned, I was just a labor guy, like carrying couches.
So the people that you were working with would never approach you afterwards and sit you down, and you never went through what had just happened?
No. Do you know what? Ray Turner always said, you know, there's two people out there. There's the people who are good for the job and the people who are bad for the job. The people who are good for the job have the sort of ideology that when they see a dead body, the realization that they're dead and I'm not. And that puts a skip in my step. And the bad people are the ones who kind of just get sick and tired really quickly when they see the body.
Right. I think a lot of our audience would be sympathetic with that second kind of person.
Yeah.
And just a final question for you, because I understand that you're no longer doing this kind of work.
Yeah.
Would you do it again?
No. I would not.
It's a talk radio trope to close off your segment with some grand revelation about how you, as a host, were changed by the story. But I really think there's no other way to close out this piece. I went into my talk with Ian expecting to get into the emotional intricacies behind working with the deceased. I expected him to be empathetic and almost somber. But those expectations were quickly shattered. Ian was blunt, if not sincere, in the most literal sense of the word. To him, body removal work is a job, just like any other. Perhaps what Ian's boss Ray told him is true. There are two kinds of people in that line of work, ones who are fit for the job and others that aren't. Speaking with Ian gave me a new perspective on death. Perhaps it's a much more mundane experience than I initially thought. To some extent, I will always consider death a visceral, emotion-laden experience for everyone involved. But to some extent, it is comforting to know that there are people who are unmoved by the cessation of it all. I'm glad there are people like Ian.
Thank you to Costa Prodanovich. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned. Oh, excuse me. We're actually about to wrap things up. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver or online at CITR.ca. Thank you for being with us.
Unfortunately, that is our program for today, January 9th. Today's newscast was brought to you by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us next Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Alex Sarah Davis.
And I'm Rohith Joseph. Today's broadcast was produced by Marco Prodanovich. From the entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Stranded right here on CITR 101.9 FM.